What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump. And it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show. And the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners. And if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter, and it'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. Today on the pod, we got Jake Dello, Pete Mc...
Oh, wait. What's up?
Yeah, sorry, there we go.
Are we still
Yeah, no, we should. We should.
Am I just interrupting people, but...
No, that's how we should do it. I have an instinct to skip over you for some reason.
At least he says it.
Truth to power. Pete McKenzie.
Hey.
And Gabby Magnuson.
Hi.
So two quick hits before we get started. One, congressional Democrats are not so different. They're like congressional Republicans, except minus the Trump cult. They're completely... They're in the House, you know, that's where the Justice Democrats are. That's where you have the AOCs and the Ro Khannas. But they're also they're outnumbered by a lot by what I would call kind of like unipolar moment hawks, which is Democrats who don't think of themselves theologically about defense or national security. They think of themselves as being pragmatists about national security. Oh. But that smuggles in the there's no such thing as like no ideology, right? That agnostic pose smuggles in a very like what I would have considered a right-wing bias, or at least it's a bias that ends up favoring Republicans, which is it comes from this long history of Democrats being on the defensive for being quote unquote weak on national security. And the way that they remedied that was to build a farm team of technocrats that would support the Democrats. A lot of this came up in the 90s. And actually, we on the Matt Duss interview pod, we talked a little bit about this. And that farm team of experts on defense and national security stuff who were firmly aligned with the Democratic Party, they were the Mandarins. This is where I come from. To be honest, this is where like a lot of my friends reside. But they are completely... blinded to the fact that they subscribe to what's a shade of neoconservatism on foreign policy. It's a muscular liberal internationalism that sort of cements the centrality of militarism in U.S. foreign policy. And the reason I'm bringing this up now as news is because the House Democrats, which is controlled by the Democrats, right? It looks like it's going to pass the National Defense Authorization Act, funding the Pentagon at basically the levels, the disgusting levels that the Trump administration has asked for, including a $44.5 billion spend on nuclear weapons, the full arsenal plus modernization. It's a 20% increase to the nuclear part of the budget. And that reflects just non-thinking. That's not holding the Trump administration or the executive branch accountable for anything. That's just kind of going along to get along.
Yeah.
So there's this great. I'm flagging it because it's there's a couple like NGOs and stuff on the left who are making noise about it, but this is just this sort of third way centrist Democrats giving Republicans and Trump a pass on things that are genuinely dangerous. The lack of like bona fide expertise on national security, the lack of like a genuine progressive flank is allowing Trump to be not accountable in ways that are very dangerous.
To be honest, I really don't understand why these kind of like shade of neocon Democrats are taking dumb policy positions, because they can show that they're tough on war and massive supporters of the military just by driving around in a tank with an oversized and unfitting helmet. I mean, it'd be so easy to show how fantastic they are on these issues in other ways.
They might as well do that. This is just, to me, this is like old generation politics. Like, yeah. Nobody is attacking Democrats for being weak on national security anymore. That's a stupid thing. Like, we're not facing a Cold War enemy anymore. We understand a lot more about cause and effect in world politics than we did, a generation ago. And so this feels to me like fighting the last war, like being worried about being seen as partisan on national security. That's all Trump is partisan on fucking national security, yeah. Man. So at least make the prudent decisions. At least don't make the country more dangerous, you know?
I hate to sound like a bit of a doomer, but is this what we have to expect from a Biden presidency if he succeeds? Is this sort of foreign policy?
I know,
it's a horrible question. There's no real good answer, but...
It depends. I mean, everything comes down to staffing, but... Yeah. What I strongly suspect, I'm not speaking from any expert knowledge here, but I strongly suspect that he's going to get staffed by all the normal Washington people, precisely yeah. the Obama team, and even probably some Republicans. And so it's going to almost guarantee that this kind of sort of go along bipartisan national security stuff is going to keep going along. And the risks are baked in, and then you trip over into a crisis, and you've got all these pressures to do something, yada yada yada. Vietnam War, man. So that's what I'm afraid of.
At the same time as we're seeing these kind of weird supine gestures towards neoconservatism from some Democrats, we've also seen other congressional Democrats taking quite a strong stand in another way. And the example that I'm thinking of here is Senator Tammy Baldwin putting a hold on hundreds of promotions of military officers throughout the system in order to ensure that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, the National Security Council officer who testified in Trump's impeachment case, that his promotion to colonel doesn't get obstructed by the Trump White House. I thought that was a really interesting example of a Democratic senator taking a really meaty stand on an issue of national security and the integrity of the military. I wonder, Van, what your take on that is. I mean, obviously it's showboating for the vice presidency, but is that kind of more of the direction that you want Democrats to go in, or what does that tell you about the state of Democrats with regards to national security?
Yeah, there are some superheroes in the Congress, right? Ro Khanna and Bernie Sanders said about this House bill that I'm bemoaning right now. They said it was a quote, a bill of astonishing moral cowardice, right? I would have liked to have added strategic cowardice also, but or strategic incompetence. But the point is not, I mean, we should not lose the point that there are people who are channeling the proper energies on this issue, who are consistently, as a pattern, not just opportunistically, on the correct side of buying down the dangers of national security, logically and morally, right? And it's the same subset of familiar names. It just happens to be like Tammy Baldwin, like Ro Khanna, like Bernie Sanders, like Elizabeth Warren, sometimes like Adam Smith. But these people do not control Democratic Party foreign policy, and they certainly are in a minority within the Senate and within the House. I mean, within the Democratic Party, even, they're a minority. And so the like Elliot Ingalls of the world, the centrists who take this agnostic pose are the ones who dominate. So I wouldn't say that like burn it all down Congress. Like there are some people like fighting the good fight over there. It's just they're vastly outnumbered, vastly outgunned. And even if the Democrats like take back the Senate, something else also has to happen for this dynamic to change. Because if Democrats like own the House and own the Senate and own the presidency, that doesn't matter if the majority of those Democrats in power are doing the technocratic pose that's apolitical or bipartisan or whatever, or is afraid of being attacked as weak on national security. That's all bullshit. And so, like, it's not just enough to win the elections. Like, we need something additional. In other news, slightly less partisan, actually, it's still partisan, but just not America partisan.
I was going to say, yeah. It's nonpartisan. Yeah.
So the G7, right, the group of seven, the big nations who, like, informally steer the global economy. For a while, we were inviting Russia, and then Russia got kicked out for invading Ukraine, and Trump has tried to bring Russia back in. But the latest move has been to try and bring Russia back in conjunction with a number of, like, I don't know, quote-unquote middle powers. So it's, like, yeah. India, Australia, and South Korea. And it's like, okay, if you add these guys in, it kind of dilutes the focus away from Putin a little bit, and then Putin can be in. And so that was what Trump has proposed. And fucking Japan, which is the only Asian country in the G7, right? And there's this long history of Japan being the only Asian country, or the only government that's Asian at the country club. They're the only one who gets to have an empire in Asia who's not European. Right. Yeah. They're the only, like, they fancy themselves as being like the token Asian guy at the party kind of thing. And so they don't want more Asians at that party. They like to be elitist and exclusive about this. And so they're actually actively lobbying right now, government of Japan, to keep South Korea out of the G7. Not Australia, white, not Russia, white and evil. Not fucking India, which is not white, so that's understandable, right? But not from my perspective, from Japan's perspective. Like fucking South Korea. So South Korea, their reasoning is that South Korea is not fully aligned in lockstep with, like, Australia and the UK and the US on China. But, like, nobody's in lockstep on China, to be honest. Positions are all over the place. Everybody's politics is, like, kind of eclectic or pluralist on the China question. It's all contested kind of everywhere, except maybe in Washington. But it's just a huge, to me, it's a big deal that Japan is actively trying to keep South Korea. It's a fucking meeting. It's a country club meeting. The G7 doesn't have any actual power.
Yeah.
So, like, what are you doing? You're just feeding the rivalry dynamic between Japan and South Korea, which is getting worse every day. And I feel like nobody's paying attention to this. And it's partially because of the United States. And so bringing it up now, I guess.
I was going to say, how much of it do you think, like, Japan trying to keep South Korea out is due to, like, personal politics more than anything?
To me, it seems like petty rivalry stuff. I don't think this is actually about China.
Yeah.
That's just the excuse, because they think that's, one, because you do have to have an excuse if you're going to do something like this. But yeah. Two, like, they think that's the argument that will sell best to Washington. And in that respect, I think it's, like, it's smart in a clever kind of way. I just feel like this is not smart politics in general. You want to be inclusive. You want to have democracies on the same side. You don't want to carve South Korea out from these other countries. If you're going to be successful with an anti-China coalition, you really do need countries like South Korea to go along.
Ironic that they still call it the G7, though, isn't it?
Even as the numbers increase, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the most, it sounds like the most anti-global thing.
Yeah.
Like, if you're not allowing any global powers into it.
It's weird. That and, like, the BRICS, if you remember, like, for most of the 21st century, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the BRIC countries, got lumped in together as some sort of entity that had something in common. And, like, in hindsight, like, they really had jack shit in common. There was literally a American management consultant who came up with that in a paper, who, like, just was writing a paper about emerging markets or something, and then labeled the BRIC countries as, like, this block of future power and desirable and investment, et cetera. And people, like, it took on a life of its own. But those four countries don't have a fucking thing in common. And so it was super weird. And to me, the G7 is a little bit like that too. And then even expanding it to, like, the G20, okay, I mean, what the, like, What's the difference between that and just having all the OECD countries? So like all the developed economies, right?
Yeah.
Or is it going to be a concert of democracies? Because then you could have the regime type being the rationale. But like you've got a mix of authoritarian regimes here and democracies. So like that's clearly not the criterion. What is the logic other than like these are big countries that are friendly with each other? But you can't even say that because fucking Russia is going to be there. So like it's weird.
It's the country club dynamic you said, man. That's exactly it. That's the only entry requirement.
Yeah. Japan will let South Korea in if South Korea will be the golf caddy.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, Prediction Market, question one this week. Will China follow up on their threat of corresponding measures towards the United Kingdom before September regarding the Hong Kong issue at the moment?
What is the Hong Kong issue?
The Hong Kong issue being that the United Kingdom has offered to take in people essentially fleeing Hong Kong. And the CCP has said, if you do that, we are going to institute some corresponding measures, which seems incredibly sinister.
Yeah.
And they haven't quite said what they are. So are they going to put them in before September, do you think?
I think so. I'm not sure how stringent it will be. The problem here is that the UK... I mean, it's not like the UK is going to go to war with China.
No.
So it seems to me they don't have a BATNA or like a best alternative to a negotiated agreement. They have no like, what's their leverage here, right? It's China who has physical control and proximity to and of Hong Kong. So China can physically prevent most Hong Kongers from leaving. The corresponding measures surely is going to be something to do with preventing, you know, people with a certain political profile from taking flights to the UK or something, you know. China will do something. Yeah.
Shit. It just sounds really sinister. You know, corresponding measures. They won't tell you what it is, but they'll be doing something.
Yeah, it's very North Korean.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Question two. Will any other NATO members withdraw from Operation Sea Guardian before November?
So for people who are not clued in, because frankly I wasn't before like yesterday, the French have said they're not going to play in this exercise because of some incident with Turkey. Yeah. And so they're just abstaining. It's not like an anti-NATO thing. It's a protest of Turkey. And so I'm going to say that no other countries will join the French in withdrawing. I think for the French, it's just a protest signal. There is like a larger meta question about the future of NATO versus like a European defense union. And the French are one of the leading voices in that movement, but they're not anti-NATO. I mean, like it's not I don't see this becoming, I think this has to do with local proximate factors and not some big existential test for NATO thing, I guess is what I would say.
Okay, well, that's optimistic. Question three. Will any other nations issue arrest warrants for Donald Trump as Iran has before August?
I sure hope so.
My favorite story of the week, this one.
I sure hope so. No, but on this one, me and Iran are, you know, on the same page. I think it was illegal. And that's, you know, the smartest legal minds on CNN, for whatever that's worth, all judged the assassination of General Soleimani as illegal. It was an act of war. And we're not at war with Iran. So that's not permissible. Also, there's been an executive order against assassinations. Presidents can overturn executive orders, but the executive orders have the force of law unless Congress writes a law that supersedes an executive order. So this, by every like estimation, was illegal in addition to being stupid. So I'm not surprised that Iran issued an arrest warrant. I think it's legally defensible, and I don't know. I expect more to come.
The part I love was that they asked Interpol for help. They asked Interpol.
Yeah.
That would have been a fucking boss move. That would have been intense.
I mean, is there like any chance like Interpol would have said yes, or would it always have been no?
I guarantee you there was a bunch of people at Interpol saying exactly what I just said, being like, good on you. Like, that's fine. Like, we would love to help you. Obviously, we can't. So get the fuck out of here. But, you know, God bless. That I'm pretty sure that that's how Interpol responded.
That would have been a great day at work, I'm sure. Can we arrest the president or not? Well, that's Prediction Market this week.
Nice.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
So for Stay Off Twitter this week, I've just got one from buddy Andrew Carr at the Australian National University. And he's responding to he's a professor there, but he is responding to a PhD student at ANU. And the PhD student, Simon Copland, said, "Sometimes I really feel like I just can't keep up with everything going on in my research field, and that somehow makes me a bad academic. Right? With so many news events happening, today has been one of those days." Andrew responds to that saying, "You simply can't cover it all. The greatest academic I ever knew, Desmond Ball, told me that he only ever read for his current project, like he didn't read anything else. And that guy worked 7 hours a day on research, including Christmas, wrote 30 plus books, and he literally helped save the world with some of his research on nuclear alert posture. You cannot cover it all." And this is not a hot take per se, but this is super important for like perspective, like to keep in mind.
Yeah.
I thought this was great advice. And I feel like this all the time because I'm stretched in so many different directions that I really have to prioritize the kinds of information I take in. And to be honest, like if it wasn't for me needing to show up to do this podcast every week, I would not even be clued in about current events.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
This is a forcing function for me to like stay abreast of what's going on. And hopefully that's what the podcast is for you guys.
I definitely feel Simon Copland's pain. Feel like a bit of an idiot sometimes when you're meant to be studying the subject and you don't know half what's going on, but you physically can't take it in and do it all properly. So it's a great tweet.
And every couple months, there's new journals with new articles. So like, it just keeps fucking coming, man.
Sweet. So cracking on, my first tweet for the week comes from Michael McFall, who I'm pretty sure we've mentioned a couple of times already in the pod. So his tweet goes pretty hard, saying, "The divergent response from some to the assassination of Americans in Benghazi and the assassination of Americans in Afghanistan is striking." That's
boom.
Crazy.
That's it. I mean, he's talking obviously about the Russian bounty assassinating American soldiers in Afghanistan, which Republicans are eerily quiet about. They don't seem to be super concerned about this, but it is these exact same people, the Tom Cottons, the Mike Pompeos of the world, who were ready to start a war against the Democratic Party, against anybody, everybody, for a few soldiers getting killed and an ambassador getting killed in Benghazi in, I believe it was 2013. They had hearing after hearing. They created Benghazi committees. They wasted so much taxpayer dollars, time, agenda time for the Congress, all on chasing the shadows of this fucking Benghazi tragedy. And the scale of it is so much smaller than what's been happening in Afghanistan. It's so much smaller compared to the body count of COVID and everything else that they ignore. So the hypocrisy is on display, and Mike McFall is happy to highlight that. So shout out to Mike.
Makes me really feel for the service members in the United States. Like it's really tragic, because if that's they're literally putting fucking bounties on their heads, and their government still can't come together and at least agree that it's not a good thing.
I know. Thank God I'm not in the military right now. I don't even know what the fuck I would do.
Do you think anything's actually going to happen, or are they going to just try and sweep it under the rug kind of deal for as long as they can?
I just don't think Republicans, they're taking their cues from Trump. So until they're willing to flip on Trump, you know, they're not going to make any noise about anything that might harm Trump's electoral prospects. And Trump is Putin's bitch. So like, he's happy to let Russia kill American soldiers. It's just how it's going to be. We have to get Trump out of there before we can start seeing justice.
It's also just insane reflecting on the way Trump treats some of his most dedicated constituencies, right? Like, the American Armed Forces are a classic and traditional source of votes for the Republican Party, and yet Trump is fine with Russia placing bounties on their heads. Yeah. Older voters are some of the Republican Party's most faithful supporters, and yet Trump has presided over a pandemic that has wiped out tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of them. You know, Republican officials and Republican office holders have stood by Trump for the past 4 years and allowed him to get away with his most horrific misdeeds, and yet he throws them under the bus at the slightest opportunity, right? It's just, it is, I mean, it's a cliche at this point, but it's also fucking mental.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's what's genuinely scary. That whole, like, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. That is nothing compared to what he has demonstrably gotten away with and keeps getting away with. Democrats, they don't have stomach to do anything other than like wring their hands a little bit and say, well, we got to win in November. It's really bad strategy to maneuver yourself into a Hail Mary where the only way that you can avoid losing politically is by winning some desperation election in a system that's been rigged for conservatives. That's fucking mental. And Trump is just unaccountable. When you can like kill people in your own constituency and they still support you, there is no logical endpoint for that. It's the fucking gas chambers. And like, I don't like to be hyperbolic, and you're supposed to lose a debate when you bring up the Nazis, but that's Nazi shit, bro. So I'm concerned, as always.
So our second tweet of the week panders to literally all the majors I've ever done for all my degrees. This one comes from Sophia McDougall. God, I hope I said that right, who is a British novelist, playwright, and poet. Her tweet goes, Roman historians. And then we had yet another batshit idiot monster man-child for an emperor, and every day was a living nightmare. Later historians. Clearly an exaggeration. Bear in mind, this was written by his enemies. 2016 to 2020. Hi there! And look, I know it's definitely more complicated than that tweet, right? For sure. I mean, it's a big boy oof. It's kind of, it did make me giggle a little bit, sad as that is, sorry.
No, it's like, so this is the levity. True. Yeah, the sad but true but funny. Or it's funny because it's true. I don't know how you like would phrase this. I don't know if you saw though, she had like a chain of, like it was a tweet thread. And so like underneath that tweet, she goes, 50th century historians.
I just read it.
The popular myth that Trump encouraged his subjects to drink bleach must be understood in the folk tradition of the meme, a late American custom which blah, blah, blah.
It's good.
You know, like looking back with the advantage of history, it's like, surely there's some inaccuracy or embellishment here. Decision-making in the past couldn't have been so crazy that like you're appointing a horse a senator, right? And it's no, dude, it was that fucking crazy. And that's what we're living through now, is like senators as horses.
If Trump is Caligula, who is the horse?
I'm so glad you know that.
I was going to say like Ted Cruz or Tom Cotton. I don't know.
I was going to say, if we got to stop calling Trump Hitler, he can just be Nero from now on.
Anyways, this was a good one.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
This week for Armchair Analysis, we'll do a piece from The Diplomat by Professor Anne-Marie Braby, who is a remarkable China hand. And her article is titled New Zealand's Quiet China Shift. And I think it's actually worth quoting her introduction for this, where she writes, in February 2018, New Zealand Foreign Minister Winston Peters quipped to the New Zealand Parliament that the art of diplomacy is to jump into troubled waters without making a splash. And that gives you the theme for the rest of the article. She's explaining how New Zealand has tried to do just that, and in particular, how New Zealand has tried to do that with its China relationship. New Zealand obviously is a member of the Five Eyes Security Alliance. It has traditional security partners in the West, but for a long time, it was facing quite significant criticism for being overly supine towards China, and it was risking that traditional security relationship. Mm. And so Anne-Marie charts the ways in which the recent coalition government has tried to reset the China relationship. It's, for example, introduced a ban on near space launches without permission in New Zealand after a PLA associated company conducted an airspace launch in 2016 from a New Zealand beef farm. It's introduced a ban on Huawei and 5G networks in New Zealand. And crucially, not only has it done these pushbacks, which have attracted quite significant attention overseas, but it's been very careful in most instances to do it in a country agnostic way, to describe it as a completely neutral following of proper process, being very careful to avoid any characterization of these policies being anti-China in any way, in order to preserve the really significant trade relationship that New Zealand has with China. Now, New Zealand has deviated from that at times. Foreign Minister Winston Peters called for Taiwan's ascension in the World Trade Organization and has criticized China's actions in Hong Kong, both times attracting quite significant anger from China. But it is really interesting seeing those quite meaty policy positions that New Zealand is taking and taking them in a quite anonymized and agnostic way. And it'll be really interesting, Anne-Marie says, to see whether or not New Zealand can successfully continue to do that, can navigate the China relationship in such a way that it can maintain relationships with both parties. It'll be a really important model for other kind of small states going forward. But it'll be really interesting, Van, you know Anne-Marie, and you've had some interactions with her. What were your takes on the article?
Yeah, I mean, she's a friend. We're in solidarity for sure. The thing for outsiders to know about Anne-Marie Brady, because like anybody who focuses on Asia kind of knows who she is, and especially the China community. But if you're not within New Zealand, if you're an American or an Aussie or a Brit or whatever, you probably think she's like a big deal, but not within New Zealand. She is, I think we've talked about this before, but she's like PNG'd here. She is censored, excluded from the party, right? She doesn't get the country club invitation kind of thing from policymakers. Mm. Part of that is because she's been on the anti-China push. Like she was ahead of her time. So she was saying this shit years ago and providing evidence that was being dismissed by the like policy elites here. But the other thing is like, she's basically like me, maybe with like fewer F-bombs, but she's like, she's pretty vocal and her style of public engagement is very American. And there's nothing that Kiwis hate more than American style. American pop culture, they're all about it. But American style, like, fucking rubs the older generations here, like, super the wrong way.
This is just so loud.
Sharp tweets, very clear. She doesn't take any shit.
My
all
colleagues.
All the diplomats and hate her.
She's like a national embarrassment to the policy elite community, even though she's representing New Zealand interests better than they are, in my opinion. And so like, the weird thing that I've had to learn here, even though I haven't adopted it or conformed to it, is like the New Zealand political style, which is, it can affect substance, but it's not substantive. It's aesthetic. It's like the way that they do their repertoire of like foreign policy and diplomacy. It is very deliberately subdued. Yeah. They're all about not making waves and trying to sort of like they treat getting on and getting along as like a virtue, even if we're talking about fucking Hitler.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is that it's like even when we're talking about a Hitler, they want to find reasons to justify getting along as a virtue.
Well, so the irony of that, of course, being that is precisely what Anne-Marie is describing in this piece, that dedication to not making waves, that attempt to stay relatively anonymous might be how New Zealand's foreign policy with regards to China pays off. So there's a weird kind of double irony in that aesthetic is very strange and it can be really alienating, but it might also be how we kind of scrape through.
Scrape through, or how New Zealand gets fucked. Like either direction is possible. And so this is one of the things that drives me crazy about this fucking place and the policy elite community here, is that like there is not an awareness that what they're doing has the risks involved that it does. They're very focused on the optimism bias and the avoiding near-term cost bias. And they think that if they get by day to day without having absorbed costs and without having made waves, then it's all good. But what that ends up doing is like you're salami slicing your own decision space. You're necking down or narrowing the range of choice that you have available to you in the future. And as you start implementing contradictions within your own policy, which is bad strategy because it's like the left hand is undermining the right or vice versa. So like you're diluting or sabotaging the net effects of your choices because you're just doing what's convenient or whatever. That's like a huge risk. I'm not saying that it's actively happening. That's what can happen, and it sometimes has happened. What Emery Brady is describing is an actual trend where you can point to a series of decisions that this coalition government has made that are effectively balancing China, that are diversifying away from China. They recognize that there's an unhealthy dependency, and they're trying to correct for it. But because they're doing it, and this is the real irony, like because you're doing it in such a subdued, don't make waves way, it's like you're trying to have the substance of change without the appearance of change, which is super weird for one. That creates, that is the cause of outsider misperceptions, because the popular narrative outside of New Zealand about New Zealand's China policy is that New Zealand is the fucking Soviet Union's Albania. It's that like New Zealand is supine. It is this like sycophant to Chinese power, to Chinese money. Like China has corrupted the system here. And I'm not even saying that's untrue. Like I have criticisms about Chinese corruption here, but there's lots of stuff that New Zealand does that is on pace with Canada, with Australia, with the UK, and sometimes doing things uniquely that those countries are not doing to balance China, to oppose China. And but their debates about it, there are no debates about it for one, but there's no loudness to it. Like you don't see people being vocally opposed to China the way that you do in Australia or in the UK. And so this has been to, in some sense, this is how New Zealand's been able to get by without, you know, being the victim of Chinese coercion the way Australia has, right? But I don't know if that's the right measure of success. That may be a misleading measure of success, because you are also at the same time courting outside perceptions that you are not part of the West, that like you are not part of the club of democracies. And so, like, I don't know if you guys saw, but Ben Judah wrote for Foreign Policy this piece that has not started circulating yet. It just came out, but arguing it took a shit all over New Zealand and was arguing specifically for a club of sub Five Eyes members. So it's like the U.S. is so fucking erratic and neo-fascist that, like, they're just fuck America. We can't trust them. So Canada, Australia, and the U.K. need to form their own kind of G3 to, as like middle powers, to collectively coordinate a movement against China. And so it's like a subgroup of sort of middle power democracies who are willing to stand up to China. And that's what they were calling for. As part of doing that, I talked to Ben about this offline and we had a good discussion, but like as part of doing that, he singled out New Zealand as being both like feckless and too small, but also to matter, but also like they're too neutralist. They're not, the fact that they're like not willing to oppose China ever was part of the reasoning for excluding New Zealand from that arrangement. That's to New Zealand's detriment. I think New Zealand thinks like, well, we don't want to be like pushed into opposing China, but you also don't want to be alienated from the democratic world. You know, like if you're true about your values, then you should be on the right side of history here. And that's not with...
This is also... I was just going to say, it's also a genius bit of rhetorical maneuvering by the author of that piece, because the only thing that New Zealanders hate more than making a fuss, getting left out of cool shit. New Zealand as a country has a deep ingrained sense of FOMO.
Yeah.
Oh, FOMO. I thought you said Fomer.
I actually said Panda.
Ankit did not write this. So, I mean, the piece is great, right? It's important piece because it highlights that New Zealand is shifting. And like the Pacific reset, I don't, people who watch Asian Security know this, other people might not know. New Zealand's got all this like foreign policy and development aid and defense assistance and diplomacy going on in the Pacific Islands right now. It's a plus up of resources and attention. It's branded as the Pacific Reset. That is balancing China, but on a local level, like in their immediate neighborhood. Right, because like New Zealand can't do anything in the Indian Ocean. It's too far away. They don't have the resources. Mm. If they were involved, it wouldn't make a difference. So like New Zealand is basically pushing back where it can within the constraints of its own capacity and within the constraints of this political style, which like should not be lost on anybody. Like this, you know, for other countries trying to make calculations about where New Zealand sits or where New Zealand should sit, This is an important thing to comprehend. They don't want to be put in positions where they're going to be missing out, but they also don't want to be put in positions where they're going to have to confront the big red menace or whatever. They want to sort of be subtle in their approach. They explicitly are trying to not be vocal, but that doesn't mean that the tide is not shifting, you know?
Well, it just goes back to old school theory for me. Like, we can't afford to be apathetic in a world that's not apathetic towards us in that regard. Mm. Like, we're trying so hard not to pick a side when everyone else is forcing everyone to pick a side. We're either going to end up on the wrong team or on no team at all, which is even worse.
Yeah, and like, if you do this too late, if you don't play the strategy game well, and then you only come to your senses at the last moment where it's like, oh, I guess in order to be on side with democracy, we're going to have to sign up for this really stupid war that might have been prevented. That's how you end up like the fucking Gallipoli gimp in World War I, where you're throwing people in masses as cannon fodder, even though you had no say in the decisions that led to World War I. So like in the New Zealand imagination, Gallipoli is this like, for one thing, it's like one of the main pillars of like their historical memory, but it's also like the main thing they remember about World War I. And it's this huge fucking beef against the Brits because Kiwis got slaughtered at Gallipoli because of decisions that the Brits made. The Kiwis were not part of that decision-making. They just had to sign on to it. It was the imperial days, right? So it's like a slightly different, you know, political dynamic, but in a strategic sense, that's the thing you want to avoid. You want to avoid being caught up where you're presented with obviously ridiculous choices where there's no winning involved. But to do the best thing, you're going to have to do something awful. And it ends up in having to have a lot of people killed for reasons that are like completely unassociated with your own decision making. Like that means your fate is up to others. You know, that's not inevitable. You can avoid situations like that, but only if you're playing the strategy game now, as opposed to just like reacting and making the best decision each time, you know? All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
The first question we have today is from David Andrews, a friend of the pod, which is, what do you think about Australia's defense update?
The Australian defense update's weird because like anybody who does national security in Australia, if you look on their social media, it's like they signed some contract that said they're only allowed to say nice things about it. And that's weird because it doesn't articulate an actual strategy. Andrew Carr, same ANU buddy from Stay Off Twitter, he pointed out that like what happens in this Australian defense update that was announced is like there is more flexibility in the Australian position, like what they do in foreign policy, than has ever been the case, because Australia historically has been so tethered to the United States. And before that, so tethered to the British Empire, right? The space of debate and decisions about Australian foreign policy has always been very narrow, and it's tended to focus on specific capabilities like submarines. Like, well, should we buy the submarines? Who should we buy them from? What variant? And then like people get all fucking up in arms because that's what Australians do about everything. And sorry, that's probably like racist stereotyping. I don't know. But like their political style is exact opposite of Kiwis, you know, which is kind of interesting. But they're like arguing for years about specific weapons platforms, but not so much about the operating concepts that employ those platforms or the larger strategy that those operating concepts employ. So like you have really narrowed what you're talking about in terms of disagreement and debate and vitriol. And that's how it's historically been. This defense update goes full high tech. It's a big increase in their defense budget and it's for modernization. So they're investing in unmanned systems and smart mines and long range anti-ship missiles and laser sensor networks, intelligence collection platforms that are sort of like decoupled from the US or that don't rely on the US. All of this is intended to shore up national defense against the Chinese without the United States. But only, and so that's huge, that's a huge statement, but it's only in the sense of like force structure or like what you're spending on your defense budget. That's not actual policy. That's not actual strategy. And so what's up for grabs is the pole mill strategy. What's up for grabs is new operating concepts for how you deploy smart mines and UAVs or anti-ship missiles, right? What's up for grabs is Australian grand strategy at the biggest level. All of that stuff is not well defined, and these capabilities allow Australia to pivot to any number of orientations in foreign policy. They're actually expanding their own choices dramatically with these investments. And in that respect, I think this is very interesting and like intellectually stimulating. And I'm trying to stay plugged in as their defense debates evolve and as their national security strategy debates evolve. The downside is that one, they're spending a shitload of money on defense. That's always structural violence. You always have to question in the domestic political context is like, is this worth it, right? Two, they keep saying that all of these new spending and missiles acquisitions and everything, that it's all supposed to be serving for like a more credible deterrent of China. Like they're not doing this so that they will actually fight China. They're doing this to deter China. I'm not at all convinced that that's how this will work. I don't think that the Chinese are registering this as some kind of threat. So like, and in for these capabilities to deter China, the Chinese PLA would have to perceive it, process the information, and then judge that it is more threatening and too costly for them to fuck with Australia. There are other calculations for why like China might not fuck with Australia or might not deploy forces in the Pacific that will be way more important than the deterrent power of Australian forces. So like, I'm not sure that the underlying assumptions about deterrence in this defense update are actually realistic. It is coming at a huge cost, like a huge taxpayer bill. So the reason why I'm not critical of it though is because like I've been predicting / everybody has been predicting for 4 years that U.S. induced uncertainty, U.S. unreliability, U.S. incompetence is inevitably going to create a more anarchical world. This is the price of anarchy. Defense spending and arms racing, security dilemmas, that's the price you pay for living in a world where the rules-based order is a punchline. And that's where we're at. And that the U.S. did that. China is the target. China is the threat. But China has always been the target and threat on some level for Australia and others in Asia. And so like the reason why you could deprioritize that, especially since 2008 when China started fucking muscling up, was because America was the cop on the beat, because America has an extended deterrence nuclear umbrella that you claim for yourself, right? Rebalance to Asia and all that. Like there's a balance of power that America is central to that like preserved stability. That's very shaky now. Like America is not even strategically coherent anymore. So it's like, it's aside from uncertainty, which is huge, which you need to hedge against, and that's what this move is, there's really a huge problem with like, can American policymakers actually develop coherent strategy anymore? Are they a net asset or a net liability to the region? And like my read right now is they're a net liability. And so the Australians, they want to keep the alliance, but they're keeping an idealized version of the alliance, like in the way it's imagined in their heads rather than what it is in real life. And they're coping with that by doing this move, spending more, investing more. I do wonder about how this will affect New Zealand, though, because New Zealand was not part of this at all. And if Australia's deterrence games with China go bad, like if they make a bad wager, that's going to affect New Zealand and rope in New Zealand like fucking Gallipoli 2.0. It's like guaranteed. The geography of it dictates that, I think. So that's a little worrying because like this is kind of a unilateralist move by Australia, even though it's understandable and kind of necessary.
Sweet. We'll move on to the next question, which is from Natalie Reese, or it might be Reese, who asks, do you have any productivity hacks for writing?
So I do, but because I didn't prepare for this, I don't know what to say exactly. I'm obsessed with productivity hacks. Like I'm always looking for like advantages, and I don't do drugs really.
I was gonna say Ritalin works.
I was gonna say I've never done Adderall or Ritalin or anything like that. I'm saving it. If I could get access to like. If I could get the limitless drug, I would fucking do that in a heartbeat, I think. Depending
Can
on
you
what
imagine
the...
this pod just becoming a like pill-pushing advertising shill? Yeah, yeah. Fuck, man.
The podcast Holy is God. Brought to you by RX.com. Yeah. You know one thing I started doing recently, like 4 months ago? Cold showers, which are a nightmare, but... they're supposed to be like really good for your immune system and blood flow and like anti-inflammation.
You people are weird.
It's hell.
Yeah, why do you do that to yourself?
It's so the reason I do it is because it's like it's training for. I heard this thing by Josh Waitzkin, the super chess. He's like a world chess champion when he was a child.
Oh,
the
wow.
movie Searching for Bobby Fischer was based on him. And after he became world chess champion, he trained in a variant of Tai Chi and became a competitive champion in that sport or that martial art.
Of course he did.
And then he fell in love with jiu-jitsu and became a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu under Marcelo Garcia, who is like one of the top jiu-jitsu guys of all time. And so like clearly, and he wrote a book about the art of learning because he's clearly learned how to master learning things, like how to become a master at something new. And so he is like a walking productivity hack. And there's a longer, you know, discourse about him that I could have. But one of his things that I heard on a podcast was like, he started doing cold baths, cold showers as like mental training. Because when you have to go up into a competition or into like a high stakes moment and you get that feeling of like adrenaline and crisis where it's like everything's on the line and you have to perform. And we all have to go through that all the time, right? Like you face those situations intermittently. And the more comfortable you are with your body being in that kind of like fight or flight state, the better you will perform. And so he was like, well, I should, I'm going off way on a tangent here, but like, he was like, you should, when the physiological response you have when freezing cold water hits you, it shortens your breath. It constricts your blood vessels. It puts you in this, it activates your mind chemistry the same way as when you're facing one of those like fight or flight moments. And if you can train yourself to be basically comfortable with it and to like breathe through it and to reduce your reaction to it and then to withstand it for longer periods and it becomes like a habit for you, then it's not going to be a big deal when you have to like face off against some other guy or like when you have to be in that high performance crisis mode, you're more likely to rise to the challenge. So it's like conditioning yourself for those existential fights. And regardless of what situation it's in. And so that was his reasoning. And so that's why I do it. But hot showers is where I do my thinking. So the way I do it is like, I'll take my hot shower for 15 minutes or whatever. And then I'll do 2 minutes of freezing cold shower at the end. And yeah, that's it.
The Undiplomatic Podcast has become a review podcast. So next week we're all gonna be doing cold showers for the next week, and we'll let you know how it goes.
Our new sponsor, coldshower.com.
Hey, Ben, if Jake's our control group, what the fuck is that?
Hey Ben, out of curiosity, I'm pretty sure this is basically like you saying so, but so something like jujitsu definitely, besides the cold shower thing, definitely a productivity hack for you, you'd say?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I benefit from it. It makes me like calmer when I come out. I feel a high when it's over, but it's while I'm doing it, it's awful. In my experience, actually, those things go together. Like awful things followed by a high. That's what exercise is, you know, like putting yourself through stressful things always comes with some kind of payoff, you know? So like it works for me. There's like a million other things that maybe I'll like bring up sometime, but I can't think of any of it on the spot. The cold shower stood out because I had to take one this morning.
And we'll have our last question now from Thaddeus Schmeckel, just a pause to appreciate the beauty of that name. Why would Putin put bounties on US troops? Who wins there?
You know, that's a good question. My understanding, so like I'm obviously not a Russianist, but my understanding of Russian foreign policy under Putin is that it's kind of a fuck you to the United States. And I can't think of a bigger fuck you than putting bounties on US troops. The weird thing is like, this is not Putin chess master. This is Putin day trader, because like you, if you're playing the great game with America, you want America to bleed dry in endless wars. So like putting bounties on U.S. soldiers makes it more likely that America will leave, unless he thinks we will literally never leave, which is, I got at this point, kind of seems like it. But like, I think Putin wins by America just staying there indefinitely, you know, and the bounty thing seems to be in the opposite direction of that. But one thing that we've seen, I've evaluated Russian foreign policy like pretty intensely in the North Korea context, and there is a very crispy, clear pattern of Putin giving North Korea aid. This goes back 30 years. Giving North Korea aid, assistance, cooperation, diplomatic summits, all that nice with North Korea anytime that Russo-US relations are in the shitter. So like whenever Russia and America are being antagonistic toward each other, suddenly Russian policy toward North Korea is very friendly. And whenever Russia-US relations have been good, Russia's North Korea policy has been pretty hard line. Implementing sanctions, not giving aid, calling up for telling North Korea that their debt payments are due and that kind of thing. And so like Russia has been an ally on North Korea whenever the US and Russia are getting along, and then Russia uses North Korea as a thorn in our side whenever US and Russian relations are like deep rivalry. Which is kind of what you would expect. And that's like a very like disciplined way of saying that Russia's foreign policy is like, fuck you. The caveat would be that it's only fuck you whenever US-Russia relations are antagonistic. But I mean, in the current context, that's inevitable. They fucked with our election. They helped get Trump elected. Yeah. They're helping Trump get reelected now. I mean, like, they are a fucking enemy. And so, like, I don't see how that's going to change, which means that Putin's foreign policy toward us is going to be fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And so, like, that's like my frame on the whole bounties thing. But I haven't seen actual explanations for it. So, like, I'm not sure if that's right or if there's like alternative hypotheses. I don't know.
Well, ending on fuck you foreign policy seems like very on brand for the pod, yeah. So we might leave it there.
Yeah. All right, gang, that's gonna do it. WPR.com/undiplomatic for our World Politics Review newsletter, our sponsor, and buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic to send us money directly in the form of coffees. All right, peace.